Hey guys, my name is Amy Coonan, and I am a millennial on a mission to eat, clean, cook, dress, and live more sustainably. It's because of that I'm also the host of The Town Hall, Rubicon's first and only podcast where we share sustainability stories from the industry's influencers and the biggest brands. Jam-packed with tips, tricks, and need-to-know info for those that want to do better for the planet but may not know where to start. We are covering it all. Last year, we spoke to some incredible people who are doing some incredible things for our planet. The executive director of the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, the CEO of Seven Generation Cleaning Products, and one of the brains behind environmental sustainability in the NBA. This season, we're kicking it up a notch. Don't forget to download and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or iHeartRadio so that you don't miss a minute. And if you can't catch us on your commute or you don't download directly, don't stress. You can check out our website at rubicon.com/townhallpodcast for recaps, reviews, and all things Town Hall. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Town Hall. We are back for our newest season in 2021, and we are kicking things off by doing something that we've never really done before. You know, I've done episodes with more than one guest, but I've never handed over the reins of the show for someone else to do my job and conduct the interview, and it'll be a unique and fun experiment. And our guest host today truly is the man for the job. So on today's episode, we have Mitch Weiss, a Harvard Business School professor and the new published author of We the Possibility, Harnessing Public Entrepreneurship to Solve Our Most Urgent Problems. And here to talk about his new book with our guest host, the Honorable Stephen Goldsmith. He's the former mayor of the city of Indianapolis, former deputy mayor of the city of New York, and is currently, and let's make sure I get this right, currently the Derek Bach Professor of the Practice of Urban Policy and the Director of the Innovation in American Government Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and I am officially out of breath. He's also published several books on the subject of data-driven government as well, and I don't want to give out all of the good stuff in the intro, so before I transition the show over to you both to talk about Mitch's new book, I wanted to give our listeners a bit more of a background about you both. So Mitchell, let's start with you. Walk me through your professional timeline a bit.
Well, my first job in public life was actually a summer internship for the city of Chicago, so not too far from where Steve was leading, although not quite the same time. Steve, I don't want to age you that much. but I spent my first time in Chicago, later for the mayor of Boston, Tom Menino, for the first time in his third term, worked on some technology there, bringing in GPS and GIS into the city. And so now I'm dating myself. Eventually came back to be his chief of staff in his fifth and final term in office and co-founded something called the Mayor's Office of Newark Mechanics, which people know is one of the big city early city innovation offices, and a number of other startups inside Boston city government. And then afterwards returned to Harvard Business School, where I had been a student, now as a faculty member, to create a course on public entrepreneurship. And that's where I am now.
That's awesome. Stephen, same question for you. Take us through some of your career highlights that kind of got you to where you are today.
Yeah, you heard Mitch say that I'm four decades older than he is, but so I'll try to condense this a little bit. I was the elected district attorney in the county that includes Indianapolis, Indiana, for actually 12 years. I was a mayor for 8 years. I was involved in the George Bush presidential campaign as domestic advisor. I chaired the parent of AmeriCorps and Vista for 10 years, Corporation National Community Service, as a deputy mayor of New York. And I've been at Harvard for a very long time at the Kennedy School.
That's great. All right. So now the listeners know a little bit more about you guys, but let's dive into everything else about Mitch's new book. I'm going to sit back. I'm going to turn my foot massager on and just relax. And Steve, this is up to you. So I'll let you both take it from here.
Turn your foot massager on.
I'm not sure. My husband got me a foot massager in my home office during quarantine. I won't actually turn it on because it makes a lot of noise, but it's pretty awesome.
All right. So Mitch, I've got the book. And first of all, let's do this in a minute. Tell us about the book, right? Why you wrote it, what's the theme, and then I want to cross-examine you for the next 15 minutes.
Okay, well, that sounds like fun. I wrote the book in large part out of this episode that happened after the Boston Marathon bombings. You know that I was chief of staff to Mayor Menino at the time. The best day in Boston was ruined, and lives with it. But immediately, this generosity starts flowing in from around the world, how can we help? A lot of it in the form of money. Normally what cities do in the wake of these kinds of tragedies is the big established institution in town, the local community foundation, that's probably been around for decades, collects and distributes these monies. But our knowledge was that when that happened, that was often the money went out in ways that were sort of too disparate to really help the people most impacted, or it went out actually too late. It took many months or even years to get to those it was intended for. We didn't want to repeat that same thing. And so we decided we were going to start our own new fund. And as you can imagine, the local head of our foundation was not happy with that. He said to me the day after the bombing, you know, you can't, you'll raise less money. You know, you can't start a new thing. We did anyways. We were up and running that night on a PayPal account, the next morning on a post office box. We eventually collected and distributed $60 million in 75 days, which made it sort of the fastest relief effort of its kind, I think, in the history of the country. And a year later, just to be brief about it, a year later, two survivors asked me to tell them a very long story of how the Boston One Fund came to be. And I told them, and they said, you have to tell that story to others. And Steve, I said to them, it's not my story to tell. I wasn't hurt. I didn't save anybody's life. And they said, you have to tell that story to others. You have to show people government can do new things. And so I was left really wondering, you know, well, which is it? Is it what the survivors had witnessed, which is that we could? Is it what the foundation said had said, which was that we couldn't? And by the way, he probably would have been right, because most new things don't succeed. And so I set out to write the book to really try to answer the question, you know, can government do new things? Can we solve public problems anymore? And in the book, I sort of lay out this answer.
So, Mitch, I think this is a terrific story that it has a number of lessons in it. And I've tried to not in that particular moment, but, you know, try to imagine a different form of government. But let's go back and kind of challenge the thesis, right? Because you've got a great prescription in the book. Talk to us a little bit about its practicality. So you had a marathon bombing, you know, a huge crisis and a lot of protection from a mayor who trusted you, right? So let's think about what are the conditions that are necessary for others to imagine the possible, right? Where they believe they have the room to maneuver. What would create those conditions? Somebody listening to this podcast wants to be like you, wants to make more creative change in their cities. What are those conditions and how to bring those about?
Right. I think it's a very fair question, because the main thesis in the book is that we need to move on in more places to what I end up calling possibility government, and move past probability government. And probability is doing the things that'll probably work, but lead to sort of middling or mediocre outcomes. And possibility is doing the things that, as you point out, that will only possibly work, which means they probably won't. And so it's fair to ask, Steve, which is like, wait a second, Mitch, you're actually telling us in more instances we should have government try things that probably won't work. And like, you're actually telling us that right now in the wake of a year where we've seen, like, for all of government's efforts, like also so many things that haven't worked. Like, this seems like an insane proposition. And so I understand the challenge there. And I think it's important to ask, well, what are the conditions that would allow for possibility government? I think you named one. Certainly we need public leaders. In my instance, it was in the form of a mayor. You've been this kind of public leader yourself, who are willing to try new things and who are brave enough to do it. Although, by the way, talking about conditions, I think if they have the skills to do it, they don't actually need to be quite brave, because we're inviting them, I am, to take on riskier projects, but also trying to help give them the skills to actually not take on more risk. So the conditions would be on one part, you need leaders, elected and appointed, who are skilled, essentially, in public entrepreneurship. So brave enough to do it, yes, but skilled so they can take on risky things without taking on more risk. And then I think the other condition is that the public needs to be in on this game. They need to be willing to have public leaders who do that. They need, I think, to even encourage public leaders who do that. And they're going to need to grant their co-participation.
There's a, I have an anecdote about every sentence in your book. So I'm trying not to insert my anecdotes in your book, but
I love your anecdotes. Give us some of them.
So I had a, after I did a few things in Indianapolis, there was a friend of mine, an expert at Columbia, who wrote an essay on the ethical limits of public entrepreneurship, right? How much can you innovate with other people's money? And you refer to that you refer to that subject in the book. So help us think about how far can you stretch to innovate with other people's money?
Well, I think I mean, first of all, much farther than we typically stretch.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, the status quo is already risky. It's already the dangerous choice. So let's be clear. We're already spending taxpayer money on stuff that's not working. Maybe it's just not working, you know, sort of slowly. And so it's not like acutely on, you know, on the front page of the headlines. But, you know, public education would meet that, right? Would meet that label in many cities in our country. Maybe it's not working because it's left some risk on the individual around homelessness or hunger or extreme poverty. Well, that's not working for them. So we're already spending money in ways that are leaving things plenty broken and plenty risky. So one argument I have, when you test how far can you go, is like, well, let's be clear that the status quo is also risky and we're also spending a lot of money on that. You know, so the other thing is that government, I think, Steve, is actually very well suited to pursue innovation. And yes, it's with the public dime, but all throughout our history, government has spent the public dime on innovation. When government was invented itself, it was an unlikely exercise, right? Washington calls it an experiment. But, you know, at the same time, they were having giant battles about how and from where they should collect revenue in this country. They were spending it on inventing public agencies. So I kind of try to obliterate the myth that we shouldn't spend public money on public experimentation. We have and we should. I do think we need guardrails, right? I mean, I absolutely think we need guardrails around these kinds of experiments. I mean, we see it right now with COVID, with vaccine distribution. I would suggest at the same time, we need much more adventurous approaches to getting vaccines out much faster and smarter and more prudent ones. We don't have, that's a false choice to say we should neither experiment, you know, none at all, or to say, you know, we should go, you know, willy-nilly into the night. You can actually do this prudently, even when the stakes are high.
Yeah, I that's a great phrase, false choices. There are a lot of false choices that hold back government. Mitch, we have time for a few more questions. Let me ask you this one, and use another anecdote. So the most important part of the book to me was the part that deals with imagination. And, you know, years ago, trying to stimulate the imagination of even people that I appointed, I found this article in the Wall Street Journal that said when Southwest Airlines wanted to turn airplanes at the gate faster, it went to study pit stops at NASCAR. It didn't go to study United Airlines or American Airlines. It went to benchmark itself against NASCAR pit stops. So how do you create this environment for imagination? And honestly, Mitch, how much of it when you worked for Mayor Menino was you and how much was institutionalized?
Well, I love the Southwest and NASCAR story because I think it speaks to how you do it in two dimensions. One is you raise expectations. The way to get new ideas, first and foremost, is to say we need to do better than we are. And so I love that you say, no, we're not going to be just as good as everybody else. I mean, I hate the idea of best practices in government because best practices are just what, best so far. And goodness knows we can do better than that. So the first thing you need to do is raise expectations. And I think a lot of that does come down sometimes to the person in charge or the people in charge. Mayor Menino was great at it. I mean, you knew him, so you can certainly hear his voice ringing in your ears on days when he was frustrated that if we had a new idea around here, it would die of loneliness. You know, he was admonishing us, you know, to basically come up with new ideas. And it wasn't all on me, not at all. I mean, to some extent, you can bring in people with fresh perspectives who haven't spent a lot of time in that same city and certainly invite ideas from them. And I contributed some here and there. But it is a lot of it's about the institution, about opening up the institution to outside thinking. You knew Chris Osgood, Nigel Jacob, who led our mayor's office of new urban mechanics. You know how important they were at opening up the entire city apparatus to new ideas and making sure, you know, we're hearing from NASCAR, or we're hearing from high schoolers, or we're hearing from computer scientists, or we're hearing from chefs, or we're hearing from citizens themselves. And so I think it's in the leader's hands, but it's also about opening up the institution to many more ideas.
It's interesting. I'm going to ask you two more questions. But I think the new urban mechanics stories are just wonderful. They're wonderful in what they contributed, but wonderful as illustrations. And a lot of this, obviously, since I was a mayor, will attribute to the mayor, but also a lot is managing up, right? So how do the folks who have ideas manage up those ideas? And could you tell us a little bit about how you managed Mayor Menino? This is a very positive question. It's not a criticism. From a person who was kind of old school in customer services to becoming new school in customer services, how did that innovation and imagination occur?
It's a great question. And I don't take it as an insult to him at all. I, because I think it's important to people listening to say, you know, how are we going to make sure that the people who have maybe more of a political lens or who maybe have been at it a while are open up to new ideas as we modernize our cities or modernize all of government? The first and foremost thing was actually not managing him per se, but listening to him and understanding his wisdom. He, as you know, was a mayor who was emphatic about staying connected to people and their everyday problems. And so when we built a quote unquote innovation office, it wasn't about innovation per se. It was about public problem solving. It's why it was called the mayor's office of new urban mechanics. And it was also about being connected to people. He was the guy who met half the people who lived in the city. So much of what we did at Newer Mechanics was about civic engagement and citizen engagement. So first and foremost, we listened to him and made sure that his wisdom and made sure that the office was imbued with a sense of getting real stuff done to solve real problems in people's lives and staying connected with them. And so I would say for people wondering, you know, how do I make sure that my mayor or my city manager is convinced about all this newfangled stuff you're proposing? I would say the first and foremost is make sure that the newfangled stuff you're proposing is deeply about solving the real problems that people face. It's not about innovation per se. And then make sure that you engage the people in your community in that effort. And if you do those two things, I think that the established leadership, the political leadership will be on board.
It's a good answer. Just quick attribution here, and then a final question. So there is this former student who's actually at Rubicon, Michael Algoretti. And, you know, Rubicon does data analytics and sensors on waste management and recycling. But he has this idea that you can look at a garbage truck and not see a garbage truck, but see a mobile platform for sensors that goes up and down the street, kind of examining the smoothness of pavement. And maybe this is an unfair question to you, but what would you do if you have mayors or others listening to this podcast that want to induce more imagination in the way you visualize and thinking about new ideas? What did you do? What were the two or three things you did to inject new thinking into city government that you write about in your book?
Well, I could be very specific and connect it back to the example you just gave of Rubicon and Michael, because we had a very, 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 very parallel idea a decade and a half ago, my first time in the city, which was we had this idea that you could actually put sensors on school buses. This was before the iPhone even, but you could put basically sensors on school buses, or I don't know that we had the idea for our waste removal sort of equipment at the time, but or even on the mayor's car, since he was driving it about all the time. And then if we put sensors on those vehicles, we could actually sense the conditions of the roadways, whether there were potholes or not, whether the roadways were bumpy or not. Mm-hmm. And where did we get that idea, and what did we do with that idea? It was from a professor at the time who was at a university out in the western part of Massachusetts, who had spent time in Italy working on their problem, in Venice especially, of erosion happening in their canals from, you know, canal traffic. So, I mean, here's an idea that goes from Italy and Venice and canals to the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, to the city of Boston, eventually, you know, to this thing that became the app that we have we had called Street Bump, that people then later, many years later, put on their phone, put in their cars. Well, how does that all happen? You invite in outsiders, a professor of engineering who's been to Italy. You crowdsource the eventual algorithm on a platform like Innocentive. You get permission from the mayor to try it, even though it's probably not going to work. All those things turn out to be essential if you're going to invite that new kind of thinking, Steve, and if you're ultimately going to imbue it into the organization.
Mitch, there's no more important time for public entrepreneurship than today, where the problems are significant at this, whether it's city, national, international level, and we need new thinking and new approaches. Your book, We the Possibility, is a terrific addition to the menu of ways to think about those new solutions. Last question. In 15 seconds, what's the most important answer to a question I didn't ask you that will excite the listeners?
If they love the ideas about possibility government and public entrepreneurship in the book, to where should they direct their energy on that front? And the answer to that question is to our democracy. It's the thing that's most fragile right now. It needs our energy and attention. Of all the places I think we should direct our public entrepreneurship and possibility government towards, it's our very act of self-government itself.
Thank you very much. Mitch Weiss, Harvard Business School professor and author of We the Possibility.
Amazing. Hey, guys, before I let you off the line, I'm back from my foot massage, and I'm also back because I'm scared they're going to give Stephen my job. You did a fantastic job. I did want to play a rapid fire game with you both. And even though this isn't a typical episode, it will be nice to kind of pepper in the tradition. So I'm going to ask you both a series of 10 quick questions, nothing too crazy. And I want you to say the first thing that comes to your mind. You'll both answer each question, but Mitch, we'll start with you again first. Are you ready?
Yes.
What does your morning routine look like?
Getting the kids fed and ready for school.
Steve?
Peloton and then work.
What was the last concert you attended?
Oh my God, it was a long time ago. The Goo Goo Dolls.
That was a long time ago. Steve?
I have no recollection what the last concert is like. Not the faintest.
What is one movie or book that you could read or watch over and over again without getting sick of it?
The Rock.
Oh, I like The Rock.
That's why I can watch it over and over again without getting. We should watch it together, Steve, next time we're together.
I like it. I like the ending of it. So I continue to be influenced by your leadership.
Mitch, what did you want to be when you grew up?
You know what's crazy is I had said I wanted to be chief of staff to a mayor of a big city, and I got to be. I mean, I literally once dressed as a voting booth for Halloween. I'm living my dream.
That's amazing. Steve?
I wanted to be a mayor. When I was a freshman in college, a great person became mayor of Indianapolis. It was a terrible job, and it never had been done well. His name was Dick Lugar. He was a Rhodes Scholar, and from late in high school, early college, I wanted to be a mayor.
What is one piece of advice that you'd give to your younger self?
You don't have to follow all the rules.
Piece of advice you'd give peers. I didn't quite hear the last word of the question.
A piece of advice that you give to your younger self. What would you tell younger Stephen?
Take even more risks.
If you could play any sport in the world professionally, what would it be and why?
Soccer, when played brilliantly, it's just fascinating.
Basketball, it's a Hoosier sport.
If you could play any instrument professionally, what would it be and why?
The piano. Although if I could be any musician, I would. Herbie Hancock has this great album called Possibilities and this great book on the same subject. And so he's on my mind right now.
That's an unfair plug for your book, piano.
What was your very first job ever?
I basically putting desktop computers together at a computer rental outfit.
Plumber's helper digging ditches for the plumber's pipe because they wouldn't let me do the cool plumbing stuff.
Yeah, and I'm sure you stood there telling him how to do it better if I know you.
Didn't work so well.
You both work at Harvard. So where is your favorite place to eat in Cambridge?
Well, so this is a little wonky, but Harvard actually owns more land in Boston than Cambridge. And the Harvard Business School is in Boston. So I would say my favorite places to eat in Boston are, gosh, I don't know, anywhere I got to have lunch with Mayor Menino.
That's a nice answer. I don't believe in lunch. It takes too long out of your workday. I carry out from Flower Bakery.
And lastly,
it ruins his Peloton workout. I'm sorry. Yeah. It ruins his Peloton workout. Yeah.
Last question, and I ask this every time, and everyone's given a different answer, and they're always really profound. What does success mean to you?
Make a positive difference in the world.
Totally.
That's great. Like I said, I've never trusted my baby in the hands of somebody else, but Steve, you did a great job and you both did us really proud today. And I'd love to have you both back on again soon. I think it's really fascinating to hear both of your perspectives on subjects that can be a bit complicated, but in order to kind of break it down for our audience, you both did phenomenally well. You can find Mitchell Weiss's new book, We the Possibility, Harnessing Public Entrepreneurship to Solve Our Most Urgent Problems, anywhere where books are sold. And thank you both for such a thought-provoking interview.
Thank you, Jamie.